The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Global Reach. This is a show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the global marketplace. This week, Paul Christopher joins us. He's Wells Fargo's senior international strategist, and he's joining us to talk about how East Asia is shifting gears. For decades, China, South Korea, and Taiwan have sprinted towards globally competitive export sector. But now, Paul is telling us, it's time for them to shift gears and rebalance between exports and domestic industry. Paul has just returned from a fact-finding trip to East Asia, and he's going to share his insights and findings about the challenges that each country faces as it strives to reinvent its primary economic drivers. Then we're going to look at the new opportunities and the uncertainties that international business and international investors face as China, South Korea, and Taiwan rebalance their economies. Welcome back to Global Reach, Paul.
Thank you, Tay. Great to be back.
Let me tell our guests a little bit more about you. As I said in the introduction, Paul is the chief international strategist for Wells Fargo Advisors. He focuses on international economic outlooks. He offers investment advice on currencies and commodities. And he basically focuses on the opportunities for all of us out in that world marketplace. So prior to joining Wells Fargo Advisors, Paul developed economic strategies to trade in global financial and commodity futures. He did that for Eclipse Capital Management. Before that, Paul supplied international economic perspectives for A.G. Edwards, which was a predecessor company of Wells Fargo Advisors, and advised international clients of Istanbul-based Global Securities on the oil-based economies of the Caucasus and Central Asia. He's consulted for the governments of Hong Kong, Egypt, Russia, Kazakhstan, and the Kyrgyz Republic on monetary policy. And he serves on Wells Fargo Advisors' Investment Strategy Committee. So we are really fortunate to have him because I think he's going to give us a lot of insight about opportunities that we can capitalize on. So, Paul, China, South Korea, and Taiwan have been spectacularly successful for the past couple of decades or more. What's going wrong? Why do you think they need to reinvent their primary economic drivers? Let's take them one at a time.
Yeah, it's a good question. All three have had successful policies or economic strategies to get themselves through this first stage or their latest stage or phase of economic development. But all countries have to go through phases where the emphasis changes or the opportunities, the advantages relative to the rest of the world change. In China, it's been exports that have really driven the economy on a very fast development pace, but it would take probably a couple of planet Earths to come up with enough raw materials to support or sustain China along that path for the next two decades. Like China, like Japan and South Korea before them, the Chinese are going to have to switch gears and go to more of a consumption-based economy. Likewise, Taiwan and South Korea, they're going to have to get caught up again to the rest of the world, which is getting more competitive in many areas. They're going to have to turn on their innovation switch and come up with some new ideas. They're going to need some new industries and some new ways to produce things in order to stay competitive.
In very, very broad brush strokes, because we're going to drill down later, what does this mean for the international investor and for the company that either wants to invest in those countries or export to them?
Well, for the international investor, first, it's going to mean that those countries will have some time in which they're going to have to decide what their policy priorities are going to be. And while we wait for those policy priorities, there's not going to be a lot that the investor can do. So it's going to be a period of uncertainty. But for the investor interested maybe in making a fixed investment or a direct investment in these countries, it's going to prove, I think, ultimately a very intriguing opportunity to begin looking for joint venture partnerships or even greenfield investments where new technologies could be brought into these countries to help them with their competitiveness problem.
So this is really going to be a technology and innovation game.
Very much so. The South Koreans are already well aware that they've done great things with their conglomerates to become world beaters in anything that has a screen. They've also done well in automobiles. But the small and medium-sized Korean enterprises really have not enjoyed the same sort of success because they've been paying the wages that have been driven up by the conglomerate. So they really, those smaller entities really need to find a way to, let's say, get involved in producing in China and start exporting to the rest of the world.
Hmm. One of the things you said in this report that you just issued, which was your Global Focus Report, was that the concentration on exports has led to a neglect of domestic industry, and those are the ones that create the most new jobs. Now, these are all countries which have a lot of people to employ. So what are you looking at here?
Well, that's right. It's quite normal for a country that reaches an escape velocity from poverty to do so by means of some export industry that is unique or that is super competitive. Many countries have gone this way using commodities. Others, like Korea and Taiwan, have made their reputations by being world-beating exporters of electronics. But as you experience that success, you drive up wages, which means, and you push up interest rates, which means that smaller businesses that service local needs, they have harder time maintaining profitability, and so they struggle. And as a result, your society ends up with a wide income inequality. That's what Korea is trying to do.
Don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You are are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone, and thanks for sticking with us. We had a technical glitch, but Paul is back with us, and we were talking about South Korea and what was happening outside its conglomerates. Paul?
Right. So the conglomerates really have been successful, but they've bid up wages and interest rates to the point where smaller companies have trouble making a success of things. Those new companies need some edge. Could be technology, could be a partnership with another company that can bring in that technology and will give those companies the margin they need, or better yet, the reputation they need to make success.
What does the Korean government need to do to help them?
The Korean government needs to do everything that it can to promote innovation and to promote partnering between Korean firms and other firms from the United States, Europe, and Asia in order to promote the synergies that are needed to get the economy moving again in a faster pace and more equally. They've started along those lines by creating a new ministry. The new president created a new ministry completely dedicated to the advancement of the Korean economy, and they call it the Ministry of the Future and Creative Science. And their job is to encourage these sorts of engagements between Korean firms and others that are interested in building the technological know-how of the Korean people and economy.
So do we know exactly what it will do and how international companies can benefit from this?
No, we don't. It's a brand new, it's a startup concept idea. What they'll have to do is the businesses that are interested should Google this, Ministry of Future and Creative Science, in order to get more information from the ministry itself.
Very interesting. Let's backtrack for a minute, because in the near term, people seem to have gone from wildly optimistic about East Asia to moderately pessimistic and concerned. You know, early investor euphoria seems to have been replaced. Is this pessimism justified?
Yes, to a certain extent. It's a reaction to the over-optimism that investors had 4 or 5 years ago at how quickly and really rapidly Asia recovered from the global recession of 2008.
What are some of the factors causing this pessimism?
Pardon?
What are some of the factors that people are concerned about? Certainly, we've been all hearing about North Korea's aggressive militaristic stance, which culminated in recent cancellation of the 53 armistice and empty buildings in China. But what other factors are causing uncertainty in the region?
Well, there's a problem that all of these Asian nations, not just the ones we've been talking about, these three, but Southeast Asia as well, they have all relied quite a bit on credit growth. Bank credit growth in order to drive their economies. But they're to the point now where, not really having given loans on the basis of profitability, they're not getting much return on investment for those loans. And so the dollar volume of loans per dollar of GDP is turning quite unfavorable for a lot of Southeast Asia. And at the same time, their consumption patterns have increased, and they're buying more from overseas. So they're increasing their debt domestically, and they're increasing their debt externally as well. That's, again, going to be an impetus to further reform.
Okay. So let's look at some of these economies one by one. Let's take Taiwan, which is probably the smallest. You said Taiwan is kind of dead in the water at the moment, and that one of its major problems are deep internal divisions over what its relationship with China should be and how much of an opportunity or threat China is for them. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Well, of course, the history of Taiwan is that the people who left mainland China after the Communist Revolution were very much opposed to the communist system, and so for decades, Taiwan and China have had this very deep ideological divide, notwithstanding their culture and linguistic ties with one another. And so there's great suspicion in Taiwan that China simply wants to take over. For a long time, it was the fear of military takeover. More recently, it's the fear of commercial takeover. You might say that the political class in Taiwan is evenly divided, very deeply divided, over whether to engage China further on a commercial basis. And because of that deep division, an impasse has arisen in Taiwan where the country has not really been able to take advantage of China as a commercial partner the way that other countries in the region have been able to do. And that's really stymied Taiwan's growth and development, especially coming at a time when their recent emphasis on semiconductors and computer chips is kind of getting long in the tooth. Computers are no longer as important as handheld devices, and Taiwan is now kind of backing the wrong horse in that electronics race. They need to make that shift, that transition. More ties with China would help.
Huh. Do they need to retool their factories or come up with brand new industries?
Not necessarily brand new industries. After all, if they decided to get into the screen business, for example, or the handheld device business, they'd be going right into the teeth of competition with the South Koreans, who have a big lead on them. It might be better, here's just a suggestion, but it might be better for the Taiwanese to figure out how they can participate in the supply chain for the handheld devices. That plays much more into the current advantages, the recent advantages that Taiwan has enjoyed with the chip sets. But they have to figure out how to do that, and they have to figure it out quickly. Another new idea for Taiwan would be to exploit its great educational base by offering more medical services, which are hard to come by on a quality basis. In Asia, the Taiwanese recently decided to start a free enterprise zone with low tariffs and taxes to encourage Chinese mainlanders to come to Taiwan for medical treatments. But again, in order to make that work really well, you have to give the Chinese visitors long-term visas, and mistrust of mainland China has held that political provision back.
Now, do you think China is going to be able to pull itself together and move ahead?
I do, but there will certainly, I think, be disruptions along the way. China needs to stop building just to build. And it needs to start creating jobs as the primary focus and profitability as the primary focus, and then let the housing and the commercial structures grow up around the profitability.
Let's back up to Taiwan, because you're talking about how they were dead, kind of in a form of paralysis. Do you think Taiwan's going to be able to pull itself together and move ahead?
Oh, Taiwan. I think Taiwan ultimately can do it. They're very hardworking. They are an extremely well-educated population. It might be that as the older political class retires and moves up and the younger class moves up, that we might see less fear, less reflexive fear anyway, of Chinese commercial interests. And I think the military angle, the military fear, is probably less than it's ever been in Taiwan. So there's some hope there.
You had mentioned that Taiwan, the one thing they have done is create some new enterprise zones. What are those, and do they have an opportunity for our audience?
Well, maybe in a limited way. The main purpose of the enterprise zones is to get Taiwanese companies to come back to Taiwan and invest, instead of just investing in China. And it's also to attract local, regional consumers to that region. They're pretty small in size, and they're sort of an intermediate step between being a closed economy and a truly free trade open economy. I see them as sort of like tents rather than a mansion. The mansion that would be open free trade. These are sort of lower, less satisfactory sorts of compromises between the free traders and those who are still afraid of China.
Now, China's been pursuing free trade agreements, and really Taiwan hasn't been as active in that area. Do you see them going after new free trade agreements around Asia or internationally? And can they do that politically? Will China let them?
I think China doesn't object to that, but and certainly the Taiwanese have long sympathetic ties with the Japanese and would love to have more inbound Japanese investment. But whether Taiwan will be flexible enough with what it's willing to allow in terms of new industries, that still remains a question.
Now going to China, we heard a lot about the most recent five-year plan and about problems that China is facing. Wages are going up. Pollution is astronomical. They're talking about a need to create more jobs in the service sector. What were you seeing from the trip?
Definitely that they need they definitely need more of an emphasis on profitability and more of an emphasis on job creation. These two things will do quite a bit to assuage a lot of the tensions that have built up in the population over the cost of living, the difficulty of finding a job with affordable or with reasonable pay. Another thing the Chinese need to do is expand the social service system and improve the mobility of Chinese citizens across the country. They currently have a system, sort of a pass system, that if you hold a certain pass, called a hukou, that pass will allow you social services within a particular city. But if you don't live in the city, you don't get the pass. And so obtaining the pass is very important. What they need to do is reform that system to make the social services more accessible to everyone in the country.
Because
that,
they have
again,
a huge,
will help.
They have a huge internal immigrant population, and which are not eligible for the social services or subsidized housing. But they still keep flocking to China's cities because even if they have to live in the slums, apparently it's better in the cities than it is in the hinterlands.
Well, for a short time, yes, they do live in the slums, but their ultimate goal is to live in the city long enough to establish a residency requirement or meet a residency requirement that would allow them to qualify for socialized housing or subsidized government housing. And typically there's also an employment rule that's associated with that. So you have to be a resident and you have to have a job, and so they put up with the slums for long enough to meet those two criteria. And then things do get better for the rural migrants, and there's millions of them.
It's a big country, that's to say the least. You were talking about China building for the sake of building. One coal fire plant a week, airports, whole cities. And now we're hearing talk about empty malls. In fact, one of my recent guests was talking about that. Empty malls, empty buildings. What do you see as the key problem here? And is there really a Chinese property bubble?
I don't think yet, but I think they could definitely get there. And the authorities in Beijing are definitely aware, more than aware, I think they're alarmed at the possibility of a property bubble. If you have migrants who leave the farms for the cities, then you need to build in order to satisfy that demand. But if for whatever reason the migration stops or slows, then you've overbuilt, and that's the danger. Right now, with the economy slowing, perhaps the impetus to migrate is less, and as a result, you may not fill some of those buildings, commercial and residential, that you've already built. That's why China keeps talking about something they call new urbanization, that we think will be more jobs-driven and less building-focused.
What do they mean by new urbanization?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure that they've even really spelled it out quite precisely. But our best guess, judging from the policies we've seen enacted so far into this new administration, is that they mean they're going to start focusing on job creation in the cities and profitable loans made by the banks, not simply lending to satisfy a quantity quota. And if they can do that, they'll improve profitability, encourage entrepreneurship, and create jobs that will continue to sustain the migration that China is just in the very middle stages of. And that will, by refocusing away from the building and onto the profit motive and the employment motive, I think they'll avoid that property bubble that so many people are afraid of.
We had an earlier show a couple months ago, Guillaume Coppard calling from Mexico, and we were talking about global mega-urbanization trends. And you're right, China still has a long way to go. We're talking about hundreds of millions of people still moving from the provinces into the cities and new cities being built. What kind of opportunities does that create for our audience?
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting because, of course, with the overall focus, new focus on consumption, it's going to mean that those people are going to need services. And China's service sector is probably houses the most inefficient sectors in China's economy today. That's going to provide opportunities, we believe, for foreign companies that have expertise in service provision, especially medical services and also agriculture, banking and finances as well, as China opens its banking system to global competition. These are all service areas that China is going to need much more of, and not just in the big cities, but in the second, third, and fourth tier cities, and there are dozens of them.
In the meantime, Paul, what does all this mean? What do all these empty buildings mean for the international property investor and for those who are investing in kind of the property funds and property-backed securities? What do they need to know right now for the next year?
I was going to say, I think these empty buildings, as long as they remain a focus of concern for a bubble, they will probably lay heavily on the returns in global REITs. You also have not just what's going on in China, but a gradual, a general slowing of economic activity and high property prices in many other places, including Taiwan and Korea. And that's going to mean that global real estate is probably going to need a period of consolidation here, and at least long enough to see that China's new policy is going to be less supply-focused and more demand-focused in terms of real estate development.
Are we going to see plunging prices the way we did in the U.S. and Spain?
I think that's unlikely because you have such high savings rates, very high down payment rates, and very low loan-to-value ratios in China compared to the places that had the problems in the last decade. But it's still possible that China could miscalculate, overbuild in the coming years, and create the sort of bubble that could only be corrected by sharply falling prices. But at this point, I doubt it.
You know, speaking of those high savings rates, I've been kind of haunted by something you wrote in your report on China's ghost banks. What are they?
Well, the ghost banks or the shadow banks are non-bank financial institutions, maybe a trust company, for example, that are trying to give China's depositors a way to beat or get around the caps on deposit rates, which are currently 3%. So you might have, a trust company that says, I'm going to go to that bank down the street and offer their customers a 6 or 7% return. And the projects that I'm going to be using to generate those returns might be, let's say, some real estate development projects that I found out about here in my home province. Now, it might be that those real estate projects developers went to the bank first and couldn't get a loan. And so now they've turned to the trust company as a way to secure them funding. In some cases, the shadow banking is a way to get credit for otherwise not credit-worthy customers. But that's probably a small portion of the shadow banking. I think a much larger portion is where the banks themselves set up entities that will give depositors access to the bank's assets, the asset side of the bank's balance sheet. For example, banks have letters of credit. Banks have a different longer term or perhaps 3, 6, 12 month deposits or lending arrangements with other banks. Why couldn't the bank let the customers, the deposit customers, have access to some of the returns on those assets? And indeed, that's quite the majority of what the banks have set up.
Sure.
If you think about it in a developmental sense, it's like an early form, a pre-form of a CD for depositors.
You know, on that note, we got to go to break now. When we come back, I want you to tell us more about that and whether there is an opportunity here for international financial companies. I also want to also talk about what's happening with China's currency and whether the banking sector is actually opening up more for foreign banks. Also, don't go away because at the end of the show, we'll tell you how to get Paul's new report, Shifting Gears in East Asia. Don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick-and-mortar locations or traditional banker's hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and, of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with my guest, Paul Christopher. He is Chief International Strategist for Wells Fargo Advisors, and we are talking about shifting gears in East Asia. And if you stick around to the end of the show, we'll tell you how to get Paul's new report, which is coincidentally or not coincidentally called Shifting Gears in East Asia. Now, when we went to break, Paul, we were talking about this ghost bank, this new proto-CD phenomenon. What kind of opportunities does that offer to our audience, those in the financial sector, alternative investors?
Well, a few minutes ago, we mentioned that that China is going to be in need of ways to make its service sector more efficient. That's going to mean expertise from foreign companies that have a lot more experience, in this case, in the realm of non-traditional banking or non-traditional lending. A trust company, someone with a trust company background, someone with a background in how to develop products besides just straight commercial and residential lending might have opportunities here.
Okay. Let's shift a little bit to the bigger financial reforms that China's making and see what that's going to do for the international business sector. What about the renminbi reforms and liberalization of money flows? Is China really serious here?
Yes, they are. China's got a closed capital system right now. Money is basically not allowed in or out of the country without permission. And this exchange rate, of course, is controlled to ensure that they keep control of the overall system. But China wants to force its banks to become more profitable. And they want to force their banks to make loans on more of a competitive and profit-driven basis. That's going to mean exposing China's banking system to international competition, including lots of foreign banks to come to China and show China's banks exactly how to compete. In order to get to that point, they have to free up the exchange rate and allow capital to flow freely into and out of the country. They're very serious about that and have already begun the preliminary steps.
Okay. In terms of the banking sector, where are we going with that now?
Well, in the coming years, and I think it will take years, the banking sector has to first be told not to stop making loans just on a quota or quantity basis or criterion. They need to become more profit oriented. That's going to be difficult for China's banks, and some of them are still state owned. But if they can free up the exchange rate, they'll allow those banks the opportunity to be able to make loans based on international competition from foreign banks. I think that will go a long way towards helping them become more profitable and sustainable.
How much is that going to fuel China's overseas investment binge? Because we've really been seeing, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, not that long ago, China is really aggressively investing overseas. They're using all that spare cash they've piled up by financing the U.S. debt and European debt. And really they've gone and doing major acquisitions, Latin America, rest of Asia, Africa.
I think you'll see China become more interested in foreign investment in the future on a more sustained basis because they'll be more interested in driven by yield and the need for profit. Recently, the external flows or the flows out of China that we've seen have reflected, I think, more a pessimism about China. I wouldn't want to see that kind of flows continue. But as China becomes more competitive, then yes, we should expect the search for yield to take them even overseas.
Well, they're certainly investing in resources and raw materials and building infrastructure to get those raw materials out. It's going to be interesting to see where they go from there.
Mm-hmm.
We go back to South Korea and Taiwan. We really sort of gave South Korea in particular short shrift. What do you see happening there? We talked before the show about rising income inequality, rising suicide rates. How does that tie in with South Korea's need to find new economic drivers?
Well, right. The Chaebol system is the system of conglomerates that other developing countries have used over the years in order to have the government direct the successful sectors of the economy in order to produce revenue, foreign exchange reserves, and employment. That system served Korea well for decades, just as it did for Japan, but now they need to make a change. They have too much income inequality. Inflation-adjusted wages in South Korea have gone nowhere for a decade, and they have a problem in that the income inequality has produced the sorts of social tensions that lead to high divorce rates, suicide rates, and general dissatisfaction with the government. So if they're going to maintain social cohesion, I think South Korea really needs to find a way to live with the Chaebol, but at the same time to have other industries that are innovative and creative, that are profitable and create jobs.
Now, you talked about their Ministry of the Future and the technology creativity. What else should international companies be looking at in South Korea?
South Korea has quite a well-educated workforce, extremely well-educated workforce. International direct investors, people interested in joint venturing or setting up new operations, should be looking for industries or businesses in South Korea that could become very competitive if they had some sort of new edge. You would need to be looking to take advantage of the well-educated and highly English-speaking workforce in a way that would help them exploit some relationships that they already have, perhaps supply chain relationships, perhaps customer relationships, but by building with new products. And the new products would involve technologies and let's say characteristics that previously those companies have not been able to offer.
Can you give us any kind of specifics? What areas you think might be really fruitful?
Anything in the manufacturing sector, especially precision equipment, and anything relating to automobile part manufacturing. You know, automobile parts have gotten quite precise. and quite detailed, to the point where some automobile makers rely on quite a variety of suppliers today. I would say any investor who has expertise in making the sorts of precision parts that go into the modern day automobile, or let's say medical equipment, those would be good places to start by considering the South Korean worker who is very highly educated and motivated, and taking advantage of whatever investment incentives or tax incentives the Korean government might want to offer.
Now, I did some work last year on fiber reinforced plastics, the use of those in the automotive industry, and carbon fiber reinforced plastics. Is that what you're thinking of? Are you thinking more of the whole computer driven side of the automobile?
Oh, no, absolutely both. Both, and probably even then some.
What's the then some?
Well, you know, I'm not that familiar with all of the different component parts of an automobile, but I can tell you that South Korea is already relying quite a bit on manufacturing that's taking place all around the world. So are the Japanese, and any sort of component part in that process is very likely to be a good candidate to develop new relationships in South Korea.
Now, on the medical device side, is there room for the small and medium-sized companies?
Yes, there is all over the world, in fact, and I believe you'll find that U.S. companies, and European too, are some of the leaders there globally. It doesn't have to be a scale operation, but what you're looking for is that well-educated workforce with an eye for precision and the ability to get the financing that you need. Those seem to be ingredients that we saw present in South Korea.
Are there any barriers to joint ventures now in Korea, particularly on the tech and innovation side?
There could be. I'm not that familiar with the level of detail, but that's certainly something that could be explored. I think you'll find South Korea, on the whole, to be less interfering and less interventionist than other countries.
What are you telling portfolio investors when it comes to South Korea? What should they be looking at?
For portfolio investors, we still look for a rebound in South Korea's markets this year. The worries and fears about North Korea certainly weighed on South Korea's market earlier this year. The yen's depreciation has been another negative factor. We think those factors have either played out in the case of North Korea or are about to play out in the case of the yen. That should give investors a new chance, especially with the latest rate cut in South Korea, to reconsider South Korea and look and play the rebound in the coming two quarters.
When you were over there, how much worry did you run into about the threats that the North is making?
Because to be honest, none. The South Koreans were out shopping. They were out eating in restaurants and enjoying coffees in the cafes. They continue to see, just as we saw at our first visit in 2012, the North is really a threat to extort, but is much less, in their opinion, overall, a threat to action.
Even with the cancellation of the armistice agreement?
Well, they've actually done that before. They did that in 2009. And so a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the tricks, a lot of the tactics used by the North this time are familiar to the South Koreans.
Is there any risk that if the North threats get dismissed, that this new, young, have-to-prove-myself leader is going to ratchet things up and actually take some action?
Oh, there's always that possibility, but in investing, you really have to play the odds, and I would say the odds on that happening are very, very long. I do believe the North Korean leader, as young as he is, especially needs to establish his credentials, let's say, as a leader, but he needs mostly to do that internally, and we believe he's well along in the process there. Had the privilege of speaking with a former South Korean former foreign minister and an ambassador to the U.S. who echoed that sentiment and said, yes, this new guy has been in the process of showing the military and the Communist Party who's the boss. In the process of doing that, he broke a few eggs that led to the nuclear test on February 11th. Then there was a subsequent UN sanctions against the Koreans that we think stung the northern leadership and led them to bluster a bit about long-range missiles hitting Spokane, Washington, Washington, D.C., Guam, Hawaii, etc. As soon as Secretary of State Kerry offered new talks, the rhetoric and the saber-rattling settled down.
I did see one other thing. It's also planting time Korea, and apparently the Army has to go help plant the crops.
Yes, the country is starving. They can sustain only 60% of their total grain needs. The rest of it has to come from China, the United States, and elsewhere.
Okay. Listen, we have to go to break now. When we get back, I want to look a little bit at what's going on with those rocks in the South China Sea and also what the knock-on effects are to Africa, Latin America, Europe from this potential rebalancing in East Asia. And also, before the end of the show, we will tell you how to get Paul's report, Shifting Gears in Asia. Don't go away.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. This is your host, Tay Revez, and I'm here with my guest, Paul Christopher, Senior International Strategist from Wells Fargo Advisor. When we went to break, we were looking at some of the geopolitical issues. We were talking about North Korea's threats, but there is another rising situation, and that is China's increasing militancy over disputed islands in the North China Sea. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, there've long been, I'll call them rocks. They're hardly worthy of being considered islands in many cases. But these outcroppings that come up above the sea level have been completely ignored for millennia, but have recently been tapped or cited or referenced as potential places of quite a bit of energy resources in the seabed around those rocks. Suddenly the countries in the neighborhood are very, very interested in what might be below the sea level there, and China has been very aggressive, but let's call it assertive, in trying to establish its historical claim on many of these places. Of course, all the other nations in the region also have their historical claims, and so there's been quite a diplomatic row over what belongs to whom.
What do you think is going to happen there? What should we all be concerned about?
Well, there's still quite a bit of diplomatic tension, especially between the Japanese and the Chinese. There was a bit of a confrontation, some smashed windows, some burned cars last year as Chinese anger spilled over against Japanese products in their country. While we were in Beijing, we saw Japanese cars with bumper stickers that said, hey, don't blame me, I'm still a Chinese patriot. You know, on the backs of their Japanese cars. So I think the diplomatic tension will increase. The U.S. is going to be dragged into this as well, since we have increasing interests in the Western Pacific, not least Japan, but also now Vietnam, the Philippines, and other places. So as a counterweight to China, the U.S. will be dragged in. It's possible that there could be some shooting here, but I don't think we're going to see a regional conflict.
It almost seems like, you know, much ado, as they say, about nothing. But as you say, it's really what's under the water.
And as long as that doesn't go away, the problem won't go away.
And China is an energy omnivore.
Right.
Let's look a little bit beyond the region. What are some of the knock-on effects from East Asia's rebalancing that we're going to see for Europe, for the Americas?
I think in the short run, for Europe and the Americas, the question is how much are we going to continue to buy from China? That's the key question. In the longer term, it will be what can we sell to China? China's consumers will be increasingly interested in manufacturers and services from all over the Western world. There's also what happens with Southern Asia. Southern Asia is going to be able, we think, to export quite a bit more into China, and there will be increasing opportunities for both portfolio and real investors in that part of the world.
Are you talking India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, or are we talking Southeast Asia?
Primarily the ASEAN countries, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Cambodia, Vietnam, and so forth.
So that would include the investments that the audience has in those countries?
Yes.
So putting plants in there to sell to China?
That's right. Developments in those countries will certainly help feed into what we think will be a Chinese consumer engine in the coming years.
Hmm. What about Latin America? Cast the net a little further afield.
Well, Mexico's president was bragging when we were there that Mexico had sold its first Audi automobile to the Chinese. Who would have thought 15 years ago that that would ever happen? I think increasingly Mexico could become a source of export products to China, especially as Chinese wages increase and narrow the gap with Mexican wages. But for now, and probably in the coming years, Latin America will for the most part remain a source of raw materials for China. Somewhat slower growth than what we saw in the last 10 years, but still positive, maybe high single-digit growth from places like Chile in copper and Brazil in soybeans, sugar, and coffee.
Interesting. I wonder if, just going back to your Mexico point, whether that then is a door for the rest of the North America Free Trade Agreement countries to increase exports to China.
Absolutely it is. A lot of times people have trouble imagining what the U.S. is going to export in the future. I always say, think about what the kinds of things that we consume today. The Chinese have interest in all of those things. Many, many industries and products that are considered domestic in this country today will, I think, be exports in the future.
Well, it would be nice if all those container ships that are coming to the U.S. and either sitting here empty or going back with scrap metal and waste products actually get filled with goods. Let me turn, because your expertise, closing in on the end of the show, but your main expertise really is the portfolio investor. In like a couple of minutes, just give us some real important ideas from your trip that the portfolio investor should be considering.
It's a time of two horizons in East Asia, especially in those three countries, China, Taiwan, and Korea. We see short-term opportunities to buy in Taiwan and South Korea. We don't think, however, that those opportunities will last much beyond the end of the year, because by then all three countries should be prominently featuring the transitional policy decisions that they will have to make. Those decisions will probably create some uncertainty and maybe some hesitation and some consolidation in those markets.
So invest in stocks and alternative investments now.
Now.
Look to joint ventures for the future.
Correct.
What else should our listeners do in the next, 5 days to 15 months?
Overall, we continue to believe that Asia will come through this transition with flying colors, and so we would want long-term, if your investors' goals are long-term goals, your investments should be long-term investments as well, and we would hold all of Asia in, as part of a broadly diversified emerging market financial position in stocks and in bonds.
Individual companies, funds?
You could do that, but it's probably more cost-effective to just buy a fund that holds all emerging markets, including Asia.
Does Wells Fargo Advisor have any that are particular recommendations?
Yes, unfortunately, compliance doesn't allow me to actually give those recommendations, but you can see our financial advisors who will be happy to provide those.
Okay. Before we go, how do they get your report? Shifting gears in Asia.
Well, my report can be obtained through our financial advisors, and it should also be available still on our public website, which is www.wellsfargoadvisors.com.
Or you can just click on Go Global on my host page, and I'll send you the information.
That sounds easier.
Paul, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it. I think you've given our listeners a lot to think about.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure, Tay.
I hope you come back. What's your next trip?
Probably Eastern Europe and Turkey.
Well, we'll get you back on the show to tell us what you find out there.
I'll tell you about all the good beers.
I hear Turkey is doing really well. We were just listening to the Prime Minister in the Rose Garden with President Obama. Now, next week, we're going to be talking about opportunities for private funding of social infrastructure and the knock-on effects for the rest of us. My guest will be Robert H. Duggar. He is the head of Hanover Investment, the Hanover Investment Group, and Ready Nation. In the coming weeks, we're going to talk about clean energy technologies going global. One will be the role for clean coal technologies. I know some of you don't believe those exist, but coal is here, it's polluting, and we need some technologies that at least will harness it and tame the pollution impact until we can replace it with other more sustainable fuels. We're also going to be talking about global corporate governance and why that really matters, both for our direct investment, for our exports, and for our portfolio investment. Meanwhile, please click on my homepage on the voiceamerica.com network, like me on Facebook, and please send me an email. Tell me what you want to hear, who you want to hear. Again, for my guest, Paul Christopher, and myself, we wish you great success for the next week in extending your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.